Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences on values and social policy. Tonight's Yasik Curran debate, named after the legendary Eastern European oppositional leader who died in June 2004, features four distinguished panelists. Giuliana Amato, member of the Italian Senate, former vice president of the Constitutional Convention of the European Union, and former prime minister of Italy. Stanley Greenberg, CEO of Greenberg Quinlan Rosner Research, and former pollster to Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Nelson Mandela, and others. Dauta Hibner, European Union Commissioner for Regional Policy and former Polish Minister for European Affairs. And John Sununu, former Governor of New Hampshire and former White House Chief of Staff. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Board of Trustees Professor of Law and Philosophy, Northwestern University, and Professor Emeritus McGill University, Charles Taylor.
Good evening and welcome to the public meeting, the public debate, which is being held in connection with transatlantic meeting on the issues of solidarity. What we want to talk about in this session is, I suppose, can be described very briefly in this way, that all Western societies are now facing various difficulties, even you could use the word crisis, in relation to their social policy, or you want to call it their welfare state, whatever term one wants to use. But we see in this general age of difficulties that there are very big differences, differences in the kind of welfare state which exists now, differences in the problems that it's meeting, differences in the solutions proposed. And so we have here four very well-versed people from different parts of the North Atlantic world, who will be looking at these problems, these different problems, different solutions, to what extent the differences between the supposed American model and European models are based on really different values, or are they based on rather different actual situations and so on. This will be debated in a very knowledgeable and informative way by our four panelists. Let me just introduce them now, and then I will just call on them without a long introduction when the time arises. So over there on the right, Mrs. Giuliana Amato, who was a former prime minister of Italy and is now a member of the Italian Senate. Stanley Greenberg here on my immediate left, who is somebody who has been a policy analyst and advisor to a number of governments and movements on both sides of the Atlantic, so he has a good comparative perspective. Dauta Hibner, here on my immediate right, is the European Commissioner for Regional Policy and was formerly a minister in the Polish government, Minister for European Affairs. And John Sununu, on the far left, if that's the right expression, is the former governor of New Hampshire and the former White House Chief of Staff. Now, I'm going to ask each of these to speak for not more than 10 minutes. And then, after each has spoken, we'll have a period in which the panel will discuss with its own members. So let's start right away, and I'll ask Mr. Amato to be the first speaker.
Thank you, John. We can start by saying, using your words a few minutes ago, that the welfare state is under pressure almost everywhere. And it is under pressure for not just for one single reason. For a matter of, let's say, available resources, either in the public or also in the private sectors for social activities and programs, and for the deep change that has intervened in our societies, which have brought with themselves a change in the needs and also in the risks that social institutions are supposed to cover. So we speak of risks of the 21st century, different from the previous ones, that are due to globalization, to immigrants, and therefore to the more heterogeneous kind of population that should avail itself of social institution, plus of the different needs among them. Now, this is such a challenge that there should be a sort of unanimous support in terms of we want to do it, we have to change it, and we want to preserve the basic values of previous social institutions, changing the instruments, etc., which was a platform years ago when we started speaking of the need for reform in the social sector. But in the meantime, let's say, speaking of Europe, Europe has become so wide and so differentiated in itself that we have at least two things to notice. The first one is that, happily or unhappily for us, there are several Europes in and should I make it simpler, perhaps, than it is, but we can understand each other, I would say that in France, the people voted against the European Constitution because they did not feel safe enough with the existing social institutions they wanted to preserve. Gerhard Schröder, that seemed to be the loser 2 months ago, with his party scoring around 24% in the polls, went up to close to 35% because several Germans thought that Angela Merkel, with a finance minister preaching for a flat tax, would destroy the existing social institutions. And this was extremely helpful for Schröder to go so close to the Christian Democrats. At the same time, in Eastern European countries, now members of the European Union, they are adopting the flat tax. And something, let's say, that was said to me, and I think it was a very keen remark on Europe by Josep Borrell, currently the president of the European Parliament, is, you know, all of us in Europe want solidarity. But for several Western Europeans, solidarity means preserving social institutions inside their domestic arenas. In Eastern Europe, it mostly means having cohesion funds, therefore solidarity among the European taxpayers funding the cohesion funds, but each of the countries wants to spend the money as they like it more, and possibly, he added, more the Irish way than the German and the French way, which is quite likely. And it's one of the reasons why the imminent discussion that Tony Blair wants to open up among his colleagues on the social kind of policy we want to make in Europe is a very relevant discussion for the future of Europe.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank my other panel participants and our chair and moderator. We have a politics which is very polarized, and which we have blocks of parties in which the choice actually between values and secularism has been drawn into our political coalitions and our parties and the articulation of our leaders. With one block, very quite traditionalist with absolutes. Another block where truth is much more contingent, where individualism takes on different meanings, more self-reliance. Another block where individualism is more about equality and opportunity and self-realization. One block where low tax and limited government is an overall policy frame. Another where regulation and social provision is centrally provided. We have watched our politics become more and more polarized, and the assumption is that the American people are more and more polarized, which is not the case. Our politics is for sure more polarized, and there are many people deeply invested in maintaining and elaborating this conflict in this form. If you ask in a survey, and I asked this repeatedly, a choice between a worldview centered on self-reliance or a worldview centered on community. And during the debate over Social Security privatization, the support for community began to rise and begin to be appreciably stronger than the focus on self-reliance. And then after the hurricane Katrina, a very substantial rise with people turning more and more to the idea of community, that we're all in this together and we need to address these as common challenges, with self-reliance dropping even further as a underlying philosophic position for government faced with Katrina. But I think the problem is broader than Katrina. It's a question. I think these challenges run deeper. And as we look at the Bush conservative revolution and its focus on self-reliance, but there are signature policies, whether it is tax cut-led economic growth, whether it is Social Security privatization as the way to reform the welfare state, whether it is Iraq as the front line in the war on terrorism, whether it's Terri Schiavo as a way of bringing values obtrusively into the family, on almost in every area, the public has turned against that form of conservative response to today's challenges. Now, I say that at a time when the president's poll ratings are dropping and the political circumstances seem to be evolving, faced with the kinds of problems before the country. But I also say it at a time when there's absolutely no evidence that the country is turning to the Democrats or progressives as having the answer to those questions. Ohio was a state that decided the last presidential election, a state that lost many jobs in the period of the Bush presidency. It was a state that went for George Bush. The question of why John Kerry didn't carry Ohio is not a question of the state of the voting machines and the lines. Those are irrelevant. The question is why the Democrats had nothing to say about global competition and how one creates American jobs in this environment to a state that was in rebellion against a Republican posture toward the global economy. I'm leaving us with two parties, frankly, without answers. And I'll actually close with this. On this question of the choice between self-reliance and community that we ask and monitor, we also ask it in focus groups. It's harder to force people into a specific response. And when asked to choose in community and self-reliance, there's virtual rebellion when being forced to choose, as people want to somehow find some combination of both. And I think somehow come across this existing polarization, existing political answers that they are being given to some new way of addressing these problems.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Hume.
Yes, I understand that we started to take sides, so I am on European side together with Giuliano Amato. And I must say that it's indeed not a secret that today across Europe we are looking for something that we could label European social model. And in this very, very difficult and I think also very painful search, there are at least three approaches. There are some who really suggest certain typologies. They say that there is a Scandinavian or Nordic model, there is Anglo-Saxon model, there is continental, there is South European model. And in the context of this typology, I always ask myself why 1 year and a half after the recent enlargement of the Union, where are the new member states? They do not fit into any of those models which are today enumerated by some experts. The second approach is, in fact, starts with common values. So there are common values which I identified, which are behind the social policies in Europe. And among those values, there are three, in fact, which are commonly mentioned, which is, first of all, solidarity. There is also the social partnership, and there is also non-discrimination. But there is also yet another approach in trying to find something we could call a European model. It is an approach through which we are trying to set out some broad features of the European social policy. Among those broad features, we are definitely pointing to access to education and training. We are also seeing the regulated labor contracts among those features, also the access to broad access, general access to social protection and health care. Also active policies with regard to social inclusion. We have also social dialogue procedures, and we have also predominance of public funding via taxes or social contributions with a redistribution effect. And we believe that social models in Europe tend to exhibit all those characteristics to a greater extent than outside Europe and than in particular in the United States. But let me say also that today in this debate across Europe, most or many of those characteristics, they are being called into question in many of our member states. I come from Poland. I must say that in this debate on European model of society or European social model, the new member states feature very highly when there are complaints about unfair competition between social models. And this is something which I would say is quite frustrating, because in reality the new member states, they face a much greater challenge with regard to the social policy, because they do not have what the Western Europe and also United States have. They do not have a cumulative advantages of decades of welfare states, and they need, in terms of public investment, they need much greater effort than the Western part of Europe, while at the same time the economic means are much more limited. So I frankly think that their social models should be amongst the most efficient on the continent to respect our broad common European values, and that's why I believe that it is a shame that in our European debate we do not take note of those of the specific situation of those new member states. On EU-US differences, just a few words. I generally believe that we tend too often to exaggerate a little bit the differences. Nevertheless, there are genuine differences, that's clear, but I think that seeing them in right proportions would be sometimes very useful. It is also, I think, difficult to say whether those differences, to what extent those differences are down to preferences, to national traditions, or also to vested interests, perhaps. And it's also true when we look for the differences that governments in Europe, they tend to do much more than in the United States. We have also, I think, in Europe, the social partnership, which is much more extensive, and also public sector accounts on average for a much larger share of national income in European states. And perhaps Europeans, we all Europeans, we are more inclined toward equity rather than efficiency if we are given a choice, because that's not always the case. We tend to value very highly in Europe the stability. That's absolutely true. So we look for a job for life, and especially I think in most conservative societies, a job for life for the head of family, which is normally a male. We are also having in Europe many examples of long-term support outside labor markets for many specific groups. We are also having a certain resistance to change in general, which goes, I think, beyond what is related to aging of the European population. I would like maybe to conclude at this stage by saying that what I think is important today is to have more confidence in the idea of a strong social model as an asset, not as a burden in facing challenges of globalization, of population aging, of those related to the knowledge-based economy building, the change in family status, and many other. But having said that, let me also say that we should acknowledge, in my view, that there is room also for diversity in all social policies and all social models, and that each country's optimum social model, this is something which, in my view, does exist.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I find it fascinating that as I try to look on the internet as to what the current status of discourse is relative to this issue that has been presented to us, and having listened a little bit today, I am surprised that it seems to me that there is a fundamental error being made. And it is the error of assuming that the social structure or the social compact we develop will have an answer if we could only find it. That there is a solution if we could only locate it. And I find this is really a fundamental flaw. It is as erroneous to seek answers of that type as it is to assume that you can take an automobile on a perfectly straight road and find an ideal position to lock the steering wheel and hope that the automobile can go from one end of the road to the other without going off the road. When in fact, the only way you can accomplish that task is to have an unlocked, flexible, dynamic, feedback-controlled system in which you allow it to make errors, you allow it to drift to the right, and you bring it back to the left. You allow it to be bounced to the left, and you bring it back to the right. And to me, the focus should be on the quality of the system rather than in this academic abstract discussion of what is fair, what is equitable, what is just, do we have too much government, do we have too little government. As long as the system has a dynamic response, as long as it is robust, as long as it is participatory, I really do believe in the long run, if it is truly each of those, then a good solution will be discovered and a solution appropriate to the various stages of society will be achievable. And that does bring me to an important point. Every social unit, whether it is a country, a state, a family, has stages to it. And this dynamic system I'm talking about is absolutely critical so that it can manage the difference in needs between each of those stages. There are times in which the basket of values that will govern what that societal unit wants to do and the ledger of laws and regulations which implements what it wants to do will in fact be juggled and weighted and valued differently at one instance of time versus another to meet whatever the particular issues and needs of the moment are in that societal unit. It is not easy to create a framework that does this, but it is not impossible. I'm fascinated that at the current time in the U.S., we underappreciate the strength of our own social compact. The strength of the system is, in fact, in the inefficiency of the system to make dramatic change. It requires, I believe, a good system requires that important issues be resolved not quickly, but over time, with the agony of full and hard debate, with the pressure of participation moving out from those in the center of power to those that reflect the democracy of the system. I think one of the great beauties of our system is also the fact that it is a system, contrary to what the press tells us, it is in fact a system that is both designed to be lobbied and easy to lobby. In fact, it is a system in which every citizen and every institution has a responsibility to lobby. By that I mean to tug and pull on their end of the rope on each and every issue so that there is a reflection in the process that provides the equity, that provides the fairness, and provides the reflection of the needs and wants and capacity of the system at that given moment. Now, that given moment is a broad term. It may not be a moment. It may be a year or a decade. I think a great deal of the difficulty in internationalizing this debate is that, with all due respect to our friends across the ocean, their entire discussion, I believe, is clouded by their angst over this problem they're having over the European Union and not knowing which way they want to take it and not understanding why the democratic response is not the same as the response at the top of the pyramid. I really do think that the issue is important, but the component of the issue that is important is how do we provide a framework to the societal unit we care about to have the dynamic response and the robust character that it is capable of having an effective feedback in reflecting what the members of that societal unit would like it to do at any stage of its maturity. If that system has robustness and dynamic response, I think it will be effective. And with a little bit of certainly national ego in here, I find that the constitutional structure that we have here, and one that I believe has been reflective of the hard debate on hard issues over time that have changed major policies, that have had the capacity to deal with questions such as slavery over an 80 or 90 year period, have had the capacity to deal now in our time and allows a civil discourse, even though there are extremists on either end of it, a civil discourse on the hard social issues of the time, and has allowed our leaders in difficult times to take on a leadership role to meet international crises. Those are the kinds of tests that I think measure whether the system is robust enough and dynamic enough. And I think it is the tests, it is those tests that ought to give us confidence that that is the kind of system that one would like to adopt in general terms, not necessarily to be mimicked.
Well, so we've had the first phase, but I wonder if any of the panelists now would like to make a remark or criticism or whatever, but what one of the other panelists have said or what general issues have arisen. Anybody want to?
I just want to say yes. One sentence maybe about this, how much you have to know when you want to design a system, no matter how dynamic the system is. I think today nobody's constructing systems which are not dynamic. And I think that when you know, you must know where your port is. And when you know where your port is, the winds are with you. So with any system you want to have, you must start with a vision of what you want to achieve. And I think such visions we do have in Europe, and the value of those visions also comes from the fact that they are based on a very democratic way of debate. They are based on a partnership. They are based on subsidiarity principle. And I noted the kind of negative note in your tone in your presentation. And I think what's going on in Europe does not deserve this kind of assessment. Social systems are, I think, by definition, they are like big ocean liners. The course, changing the course is extremely difficult, is extremely slow, and you always need a good captain on this ocean liner. But we are moving forward. I think we have changed Europe dramatically over the last years. If you think where we were in 1989 or 1990 with the Iron Curtain in Europe, where we are today with the Union of 25, soon to be 27, without inefficient economic systems, with democracy, which is, I think, thriving and flourishing. So I think we've made enormous progress. And we are also moving slowly on improving our social systems, which we believe do not meet the challenges, do not face sufficiently efficiently the challenges which globalization is bringing. That's why we are having this this debate, and that's why we are also looking at our friends across Atlantic to see also what we can learn from Americans. And I think we will all agree that there is no really an international set of best practice with regard to the social models. So we know that we have to look and to find our own solutions for our problems. But we are not at the starting point. I think we are quite well advanced.
I want to make the case for shared problems across and probably differing, probably arguing for the need for some disjunction in terms of how social systems, political systems address the problems. And this comes from work in the U.S., but it also comes from work in Britain and other parts of Europe and the world. In all of these places, one sees a transfer of risk and costs from employers to employees, from government to citizens, in all these, with people increasingly conscious of the uncertainties that come as they bear more of the cost and the risk. In virtually all of these societies, one is dealing with increased inequality to such an extent, particularly the U.S., but even Britain, but Britain as well, increases in inequality that macro growth, even what is seen by economists as strong and respectable macro growth, is not producing rising incomes for most citizens in the country over many years. And I think it's probably fair to say, whether we're dealing with Italy, whether we're dealing with Britain, whether we're dealing with the United States, the majority of the citizens have not seen a rise in income in a very long period of time, probably three decades in America. But the increasing rate of inequality related to both globalization and decisions made internally in terms of taxes and market power, that increased inequality creates the contradiction that strong macroeconomic performance does not produce high-level individual satisfaction. All of these countries face increased diversity and concepts of citizenship being under siege. It's less of a problem in the U.S., as we've talked about, because of the way we've accommodated diversity and immigration, but it's an immense problem across Europe and other countries that have not come to terms with defining citizenship in relationship to these new challenges. And then governments that and political leaders who almost always face dissatisfied citizenry because they can't deliver on promises, lacking the budgets and constrained in a whole range of ways, from both having the autonomy to make these decisions but the resources to make them, so that political leaders across all these societies find themselves, I think, continually under political siege. To me, that seems common across. What I'm not sure is that we're dealing with an ability to adapt. I'm open to that discussion, whether this is an opportunity. I like, as a political consultant, when I'm in that role and wearing that hat, I always like to say that this problem is simply an opportunity. And it may be, as I indicated in my comments before, that in the United States at this moment, I think the conservative solution right now is seen inappropriate to the challenges facing the country. And it's obviously a moment of opportunity for progressives to think how we act as community to address these in this context.
But, Stan, I think you're making two mistakes here. Number one, you are glibly throwing out income as a measure of quality of life or standard of living. And I think that the latter are much more important measures. But more importantly, since you predicated a lot of your discourse on whether the conservative solution or the liberal solution, you like to call it progressive. I didn't realize that your focus groups had told you not to use liberal anymore, but I'll go along with you. You're conservative versus progressive. I think you're misinterpreting the reaction around the country. It is not an issue of self-reliance versus a sense of community. It is an issue of what is the role of individual responsibility as part of a community. And I think you are going to see a refocusing of the political issues in that. Sometimes tragic events like Katrina and Rita have a chance for redefining the debate, and I think to a great extent it is there. I can tell you, and what I think has been tragic about the media aspect of the debate of government responsibility in this whole process is that all they want to do is run around and point fingers. I can tell you, dealing with historically significant events like this, there is always going to be somebody that can blame somebody else for something. And I think the tragedy of this whole thing is that there is an expectation of perfection of response that, to a great extent, is the same kind of problem that I was trying to address when I focused on trying not to talk about looking for a perfect structure of a social delivery system, that a good structure that is dynamic and responsive is preferred than an endless debate as to what we ought to have that might be a little bit better than what we have today. And I think you're going to find, if you wanted to focus on what's happening domestically, there'll be a refocus of the debate in that respect. If I may just comment, I did not mean to be pejorative in my tone about what is happening in Europe, but since you've offered me the opportunity to address that, I will be pejorative in my tone with what is happening in Europe. I think the Europeans have taken this magic formula of European Union as being some kind of a mantra. I think they look across at 50 states and say, well, we can do it too. And they don't understand that what we have done, first of all, is homogenized structures. We have homogenized agendas. We have homogenized language. We have homogenized laws. And we have homogenized rules. And under that, we are able to create a federated structure. I just feel bad for Europe that somehow feels that it's going to try and create this federated structure while preserving the individuality, which I think is the value of the different social structures in Europe, that each country there has its own character and its own nature and its different social agenda and its different social commitments. And I don't know how it's going to harmonize and rationalize that over the long haul. And, I just find it interesting and amusing to watch from this side, and I just have this feeling in my bones that 50 years from now, you'll wonder why you tried to do it.
If you allow me, very frankly and friendly, I would say that I see something of academic and ideological in what you were saying about the individual responsibilities. If people think of their life, they are understanding that they are burdened by individual responsibilities much more than it happened perhaps in the past, and that they are running risks that their individual responsibility cannot cope with quite frequently. And here we should be much more, let's say, practical, pragmatic, and perhaps economically correct than we tend to be when we use these big words. How can I insure myself on the basis of individual responsibilities against risks that I currently run and that the market is unable to cover on an individual basis? We perfectly know that any kind of insurance privately run is based on the principle of adverse selection. And therefore, the more I am unemployed, the less I will be insured against unemployment, for the simple reason that the best clients for an insurance, if the policy has to do with unemployment, are people with a very stable and long-term job, because they don't risk to be fired. This is something that it is perfectly well known and goes to the category of the failures of the market. Now, the fact of the matter is that currently people run several risks that meet into failures of the market. Having flexibility in the labor market is wonderful. there are young people who get their first job with pension contribution when they are 38, 39, 40 in several of our countries. The consequence of it is that having not pay-as-you-go funds, but funded funds, they have 20 years of contribution when they retire, and they are doomed to being poor in their late years. And this is something that go to any insurance, they cannot find the solution because they say, of course, if it is a private insurance, it is a funded fund. So you will have as much as your contributions, etc., etc. So unless there is a mutual system with some sort of solidarity and transfer of resources from the ones who have more to the ones who have less, the problem cannot be solved.
Juliana, why doesn't the system address that failing? Why doesn't the government structure...
Why don't we discuss how to address these failures? Because this is exactly the problem we have now. But in order to face these issues, we need resources. Resources have to be allocated to these issues. These issues have to be priorities. And. So, I mean, I see it in these terms.
But the point I was trying to make goes right to that, that the system, that we should focus on making sure that the system is dynamic and responsive enough to meet that if the societal structure sees that that's a critical need. And what you're telling me is that is an issue that people worry about and try and devise solutions to fit a rigid social structure that they can't get solutions through. And I would suggest to you that instead of dwelling on the issue, you ought to be working on trying to make a better, more responsive political structure so that the political structure is flexible enough and robust enough to deal with that and other issues as well. That's the point I was trying to make.
Yeah. But I think the difference between us in Europe and the reality here in the U.S. that when there are things which we have to mend, there is usually the concern expressed by our civil society. There is usually a debate. And that's why we are talking about concerns, because we are listening also to what people are saying. But that does not mean that political elites or whoever who is responsible for the change in a given area is not following your advice and is not designing systems that would be more efficient and would respond to the concerns of the people. So it's there's no, I think, contradiction in approach. Mm. We just have more debate, more open public debate on issues which are
in Europe.
In Europe, yes. Oh yes.
Oh,
very
come
much
on.
So.
Oh. With all due respect,
I can.
With all due respect, I go and I turn on the television set in Europe, and there's none of there are one or two programs that discuss this. You turn on the television in the U.S. and you can't get away from it. You can't get away from public discourse and public debate and both sides being presented. Sometimes acrimoniously, but at all times there is constant argument and discourse.
We don't talk to the people through television in Europe, and that's probably our concern.
And so you talk to and you debate with them one at a time. Why do you think television as a mechanism that can reach millions of people simultaneously should be treated pejoratively as a communications medium?
It should not. 85%, of course, European, 85% of information they get from the television. That's absolutely true. What I'm saying is in the public dialogue, we cherish very much the possibility of having also direct dialogue, and we know that you cannot communicate Europe, which we have just created, because 50 years, it's or even less, the enlarged Europe has just 1 year. You cannot communicate it overnight or through television. You have to have a genuine, direct dialogue with people, and that's why
How do you dialogue directly?
Oh, I can tell you how I dialogue directly. I was a minister for European Affairs in Poland, and when we had referendum in June 2003 to decide as Poles whether we want to join Union or not, I spent 6 months traveling through Poland and talking also to individual farmers and explaining them the things. Otherwise, we would never get it on board. So that's the difference in culture. But I want to say something different in response to what you were also saying, that it's absolutely true that Europe is in very bad condition today. We are suffering from very slow growth and from high unemployment for far too long. And that we also know that in global markets, we are very often, in many areas, much less competitive than you are, the Americans, and we know also why we are. But we have also common challenge. Both you and us, we are losing every day probably thousands of jobs to our partners in remote parts of Asia, in China, in India, and this is our common challenge. We face also common challenges in many parts of the world where we have problems with peace, where we have the challenge of having more democracy, and this is where we are working very close on Euro-Atlantic basis, and we are very happy because we know that there are values which we share, and we know that we have to stick together. Otherwise, we will just fall apart. So there is an excellent, I think, now much more improved dialogue than we had still a year ago.
I don't want to accept that this is that this social compact discussion, particularly with respect to retirement systems, is a European approach which is committed to a social solution to the risks that you've talked about. And that in the U.S. we are addressing it in different ways. We have had a debate in the United States around this question, and it may be an engineering narrative can talk about this in terms of systems, but the debate is taking place in the context of a conservative ascendancy in the U.S. that has used tax cuts self-consciously and often articulated to deny government the revenue to meet these needs. The idea of starving the state in order to limit its capacity to provide these kinds of solutions is very much part of conservative policy. It's not simply the trend of resources available to government. It is a political object to deny the state that capacity. But we had a debate over this question in the United States on the question of Social Security privatization. In an earlier discussion, someone mentioned that's one of the vulnerabilities of our social security system is the notion that it is seen as a system of private savings. But nonetheless, we had this debate over whether it should become a system of private savings with investments, and this was not a debate in which it was closely contested. Something like three-quarters of the country opposed making the change in the social security system, which provides a guaranteed income to people in retirement. So this is not just a European solution. America is part of that solution.
But it was a very – and I think the debate is still going on. But the point is that it is a debate, and the public has participated in it, and they have lobbied.
And resolved.
They have lobbied constructively, their congressmen and congresswomen and senators. They have tugged on the end of the rope that they cared about, and the process did function. And with all due respect, one of the most effective tools in stimulating the debate was public discourse on television so that the public could hear both sides over and over and over and over again and be a part of then responding and putting pressure through the political system on what it wanted or didn't want it to be.
Did you read the stories about the town meetings that the president had to construct and how they had to screen the people who attended those meetings so that the public could participate in this debate?
But the point is Stan, if you want to carry that dialogue on, let's let this dialogue finish and we can continue for another hour. I'll be very happy to go through that process. But the point is the system, I do think, is the key to the value here. And over time, it will make adjustments one way or the other. I find it disappointing that our friends from Europe have suggested that they have identified a problem and feel frustrated. I thought I sensed frustration in what was said, that you are unable to develop in a reasonable period of time an adjustment to what you see is a very critical issue for people entering the workplace and not being able to look forward to this social protection in retirement. And that, to me, indicates to me that somebody's got to go back and focus on the structure of the process rather than just the issue itself.
We were inquiring between the two of us. She doesn't feel frustrated, neither do I. So there must be somebody else there. But we haven't seen it yet.
Let
me say, Danuta, just two things. First of all, there might be a misunderstanding due to the fact that the competence is the jurisdiction of the European Union is not so, well known around as we are aware of. So despite the fact that we tend to speak of European social models, pension systems, as you know, and social security institutions and social institutions on the whole are under national responsibilities, and therefore they converging at the European level on social models implies national systems converging with each other, not a European decision being taken for all of us. And therefore, we have national debates. We have strong trade unions in some of our countries, which you miss. And I think that trade unions are an important component of a good social dialogue when they still represent remarkable shares of employees and workers. And we have several debates in TV on these matters, which are not at the European level, but at the national levels. And people discuss about their social institutions much more than about anything else. No. The problem of the youngsters is not a problem to be frustrated about. What I was underlining is that a market solution cannot be enough for that kind of problem, because the allocation of resources that you have on the basis of private insurance investments is such as not to cover this kind of problem. And therefore, you need, to say the least, a mixed system. You need systems in which resources are allocated on the basis of solidarity and not only of return. Because return is not an incentive enough for specific risks that need to be covered in the 21st century.
Well, then it remains for me to thank very much our four panelists who have given us a very good evening.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences on values and social policy. Tonight's Jacek Kuren debate, named after the legendary Eastern European oppositional leader who died in June 2004, featured four distinguished panelists: Giuliana Amato, current Italian Senate member and former Prime Minister of Italy; Stanley Greenberg, former poster to Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Nelson Mandela, and others; Danuta Hübner, European Union Commissioner for Regional Policy and former Polish Minister for European Affairs; and John Sununu, former governor of New Hampshire and former White House chief of staff. We began with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Charles Taylor, Board of Trustees Professor of Law and Philosophy, Northwestern University, and Professor Emeritus, McGill University. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skog, with help from Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.